Are you ready?
Hey, think you can tell us what to do? You think you can tell us what to wear? You think that you're better? Well, you better get ready. Bow to the masses.
Welcome to Unscripted Wrestling, a show for the fans made by big-time wrestling fans. I'm your host, Daniel Hummer, here with my brother, Doug, our producer, Eric, and with a legendary guest today, Mr. Scott Casey. How you doing, sir?
Great, great. How are you?
We're doing well.
Doing very well.
Thank you for coming on the show.
Definitely. We appreciate you joining us today, and our episode's going to be about a conversation about the territories. I mean, obviously, there was a lot of territories, and there's a lot to get into, so there's only so much we can do in an hour and a half, but it's going to be kind of a relaxed conversation. We're going to be asking Mr. Casey some questions, definitely, and we're just going to have a fun little conversation here. You just had a book come out, right?
Yes, sir, I did. I wrote a book, and it took me a little over a year, almost a year and a half. Me and my partner, Nick Massey, and it's called One Last Ride, and it's the tale of Cowboy Scott Casey, and you can go to, what is it, blurg.com. All of these technical terms that you guys are using nowadays, we didn't use it years ago, but it's fun to try to catch up with it, you know. And it's about, like an old-time promoter, Joe Blanchard said, it's full of tickles, tack, and grass flat. Anyway, but it's a lot of fun reading. And I'll tell all the wrestlers' wives that are listening, I didn't throw any of your husbands under the bus. And believe me, I could have thrown a lot of them under the bus, but I wouldn't do that. No, I mean, it's a lot of fun things that happen. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you're fine, sir. And it's funny because one of the things we still got to pick up a copy, definitely, but one of the things we've really heard about the book is it's one of the only wrestling books where you don't bash anybody. And a lot of the books out there by a lot of retired professional wrestlers or people still doing it, a lot of them, like you said, will throw people under the bus, and yours is just good times and fun stories.
Yeah, you know, it's just, I mean, you know, like my mom and dad both taught me when I was a child, treat other people the way you'd like to be treated, and that's what I did, you know.
Yes, sir. So, Doug, you got a couple other plugs to get out of the way before we get started? Or
Before we get started here, we also want to plug the Dirt Sheet Dudes podcast, Anthony Boxman and Smark. They go on every Wednesday and Friday night, 10 o'clock Eastern time, mixler.com/dirtsheetdudes. You can find them on all the podcast platforms. They're good people. Anthony and I, of course, former podcast buddies ourselves. We used to have a show, the Rain Man of Wrestling. They're good dudes. But they have two shows a week, Dirt Sheet Dudes, every Wednesday, Friday night, mixler.com/dirtsheetdudes. Also, every other Saturday, you can hear them on the Hollywood Hangout. They review different movies. Sometimes they review TV shows. That's also on mixler.com/dirtsheetdudes. That's every other Saturday. Times vary.
They do wrestling reviews, too, after all the main wrestling interviews.
Absolutely. And before we get into this conversation about the territories, there's one question I really wanted to ask you, because this past year, or last year, the Harlem Heat went into the Hall of Fame. And I wanted to ask you, did you feel like a proud father, kind of? Because it's known that you had a lot to do with the training of those two.
Yeah, well, I guess you could put it that way. I really enjoyed working with the guys. And when I had finished my time with the WWF at that time, before the WWE, when I finished it, I went back to Dallas and stayed there for a while. And I got a call from Ivan Putski, and he said, "Would you like to come down and help me train?" I said, "Sure." You know, I was, you know, when you devote your life and your time, your blood, sweat, and tears, and all of a sudden it's gone. There's no more of it. And this kind of rejuvenated me a little bit to go down there. And I was talking to Ivan one day, and he said, "You're not going to believe these two guys that are coming in to learn how to wrestle." I turned around, and here's one guy. He's like 6'3", another one's 6'4", and I was barely, maybe 6 foot tall at the time. But in time and age, you lose a little bit of that height. But anyway, I turned around, and man, you talk about a couple of impressive-looking guys, and they were. And I walked up to him, and I introduced myself, you know, and we were talking, you know, and I said, "Well, let's get with it," you know, and I showed him a few things. I said, "Can you try these things?" And it was amazing how quick they caught on to the things that we did, you know. Of course, there was some timing and some things that you did left, right, or that they didn't know, but most of it they could do. They were just unbelievable athletes. And I really, you know, over the years, I've kept in touch with Booker more than with Stevie Ray, but I was very pleasantly surprised when they had me. They flew me from Florida out to Las Vegas, and we had the thing where they were introduced in the Cauliflower Alley Club thing. And I was so amazed that they did that, and they were so proud of me, and they talked so highly of me, and I appreciated that. But you know, the thing about it is, and I don't know if people say this now or not, but I did not lie to them. I did not. I said, "This is the way it's going to be. This is what's going to happen," you know. And I said, "You either accept it and go on, or you don't." And I told him, I said, "One thing," I said, "it's not how much money you make, it's what you save." And that, my friends, is the gospel. And they both brought that up. And I hadn't seen them in years, you know. And Booker's got a beautiful wrestling school down in Houston. And Stevie Ray has, I think, some sort of car thing, you know, he does. But they're both well healed as far as money goes, and I'm very proud of them. I could just keep on rattling on, but I won't.
Oh, it's fine, definitely, because, it was definitely nice seeing them make it to the Hall of Fame, especially as a tag team, because Booker gets a lot of credit, which he deserves, but Stevie Ray was definitely a big part of that tag team, so it was nice seeing them both go in.
Yeah, they both did. Very gifted athletes.
Yes, sir, definitely. So, all right, guys, let's get into the territories, which, I mean, there's so much to get into. I figure we can just start with maybe one territory, talk about some of the guys, some of the angles, and just go from there.
Well, and also, okay. let's kind of give a little bit of a background of, like, what the territories kind of represented. And, Scott, you know this more than any of us, obviously, as somebody that's been in the business and worked in the territories. But, like, at that time, the NWA owned several territories, correct?
Correct, yeah.
And
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to tell a quick funny story about being in Amarillo, working for the Funks. Now, fellas, let me tell you, what I'm about to tell you is truer words were never said. I met a guy from Canada, and his name was Moose Morawski, humongous guy, big, big man. And we just kind of hit it off when we first met each other. And he said, how much do you know about Amarillo territory? And I said, well, really not that much. I said, I'm just starting out. He said, well, you're going to make $2,500 a week. And I'm sitting there thinking, wow, $2,500 a week. That's unreal. He said, no, that's miles. Gentlemen, we would drive from Amarillo up to Colorado Springs. We'd work there and then leave there and go over to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and leave there and go down to El Paso, and then leave there and go down to San Angelo, and then ride back up. And we did this week after week after week, you know. And some of the greats were there, guys like, I mean, well, obviously the Funks, but Ted DiBiase, Dusty Rhodes, I'm trying to think of Frank Goodish, which you know as Bruiser Brody. I mean, you know, a lot of the guys from Amarillo broke in, became really superstars, you know. And it just, but you talk about a grind. I mean, you were constantly changing the oil in your car weekly, and you were constantly getting new tires. And it just can't, unless you've done it like I did, you know. I mean, and I, being a young guy, it didn't really bother me that much. But the older I got, the more it got to me, just having to drive and drive and drive and turn around and do it again, you know. And our only close shot was down by a little town called Happy, Texas, which wasn't far from Amarillo. But otherwise, we were doing anywhere from 250 to 300 miles per night.
Ooh.
Sometimes we'd do a show and turn around and hop in the car because we had to do it, maybe a live TV interviews the next day for the next show. You know, it wasn't like they have it now. They do it, you know, completely different.
Right. And also, like, about the territories, too, is that, like, after you would leave each territory, you know, you'd leave one territory and go to the next. Did it feel like you had to reestablish yourself in the new territory?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, you know, because back then they didn't have the publicity and the broadcasting like they have nowadays, you know. You had to get in there, you know, you had to know somebody to get into the territory, and then from there you had to get in there, like you said, and reestablish yourself. And it's just like an old timer, Luthes. He was a world champion, I don't know, 7-8 times. I was standing looking out the curtain one day, and I turned around, there he is. And I said, Luke, what are you doing? He said, I'm watching a match like you. Why? I said, yeah, you were 7 or 8 times world champion. What do you want to watch for? You know everything we've ever done. He said, Scott, you can always learn something new. You can steal something from somebody, and he said it might help you get over in the next place that you go. So, I mean, you know, all little kinds of stories like that. It's unbelievable.
That was Luthes.
Luthes. Yeah, he was a world champion, and great guy. And I went to Saudi Arabia with him. And now, if you've never been there, and I'm sure a lot of people haven't, but they would let you come in the country. You couldn't. They didn't have bars like they have here. See, we all drank, and so we were there for like 2 or 3 weeks, and none of us had anything to drink, and we're all itching for a drink. And we get on the plane, and the cocktail waitress said, "Well, we ran out of booze coming back to the States." And Luce all of a sudden said, I can't see. I said, what do you mean? He said, I said, Lou, your glasses are up on your forehead. And he was drunk too, so we had a lot of fun doing that one.
That's awesome.
Now, were promoters in the different territories friendly with each other back then? Or, like, was it basically like everybody was kind of out for themselves?
Well, probably a little bit of both, you know. I mean, the promoters wanted to make, make a lucrative thing out of their territory. But, you know, if they would, as we'd say, switch talent to try to promote something that they want to do, you know. And it's just like if you're sitting in a booking session or something, it's like a pyramid. You've got it spread out at the bottom, and you work your way up to the top. And when you get there, you know, you're going to have the big blow off. And they all were trying to do that in their territories. So, you know, there's a little bit of both, maybe a little jealousy here and there, a little animosity, who knows. But it was fun listening and learning.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. And the thing, something I always wondered and I wanted to ask you, because you talked about having to reestablish yourself. Would, like, let's say if you went from, like, Florida to down to world class or something like that, would the booker ever have you guys, like, maybe switch gimmicks or do something else, or maybe you were doing face work and now he wants you to be a heel? Or did you always go in as like Scott Casey, your gimmick, or did they ever really try to make you switch anything? Or
I always went in as me, and they never tried to make me a heel. It's funny you should say that, because when I was up in Amarillo and I was out of work for about 30 days, and I get a call from Wahoo McDaniels, and he said, we'd like for you to come down. He said, we'll fly you down and everything, blah, blah, blah. I said, okay. Because I got tired of sitting around, and you get the itch to get back on the road. That sounds a little crazy, but it's true. Anyway, so I get down there, and they've got Tully Blanchard as the baby face, and they want me to go as the heel. You know, I'm sitting there thinking, man, I have never done this heel gimmick. I know how it works, but I'm not real sure I can pull it off. And we had the match, and Joe came back in the dressing room, and he was talking to Tully, and I'm sitting over in the corner undressing, and he said, Scott, I said, what? Would you mind being the baby face? I said, no, that's what I've always been. You know, he said, because Tully got over more as a heel than you did. And they wanted to, like, build up the territory. And that was my only really main time that I tried to heel. But evidently, I didn't carry that off, but Tully did. So it was a switch, but it was unusual to have it happen. But when the owner and his son is Tully, say it. You do it if you want to get a payday. So that's what happened.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And one of the big territories I want to get into today is world class. What was it like working under Fritz down there?
Well, I looked at it this way. My last name was not Von Erich. And any other baby face that was in there besides the boys, the brothers, was only going to go so far. And that's just the way it was, because the old man owned the territory. He and his bookers listened to what he had to say, and that's what he wanted. He wanted his boys over, which was fine, you know. I still made a decent living with it. But as far as trying to be on top, you may have a shot or two there, but the most of the times it was the boys, his sons. And I'm not upset about it at all. I enjoy watching them do their thing. And that's the way it went, you know. Because if he didn't like you, you damn sure weren't going to be there doing it. I remember one time I wrestled a guy there in Fort Worth. His name is Jack Victory. And we were talking back and said, I said, let's just go all out. You know, balls to the wall, as they say. And he said, okay. So we did for about 15 minutes, and you talk about working our butt off. We get back there, and Fritz came up to us, and he said, boys, that was great. I'm giving you $50 extra on your paycheck. And I couldn't believe it. And that was the only time that ever happened. But he liked it when the guys worked their ass off in the ring. I mean, night after night after night. If you didn't, you weren't going to stay there. So I was very pleasantly surprised that Fritz did that.
Right. Now, when you got there, that was around what, 85?
Probably 80, I want to say either 85 or 86, and stayed there till I went to New York in 88.
Okay.
So when you were
there, obviously everybody knows that, like, in 86, Kerry really wasn't around because Kerry had the motorcycle accident in 86, correct? And he had lost the foot. David Von Erich, of course, had already unfortunately passed. So basically, and, you know, Mike was kind of having his – Mike had his demons. So basically, like, you had Kevin there, and you had this guy that – the supposed Von Erich cousin, who wasn't a cousin, you know, Lance. So, like, even though it was just, like, Kevin and Lance kind of for a time – did you still find it hard to kind of get over as, like, get over as a top babyface?
I knew I could never get over as a top babyface because my name was not Von Erich. It's real simple.
Okay.
The boys, their territory, and that's the way they were going to run it, and that's what they did. I mean, I just accepted it, you know. And besides, I was from Dallas, so I enjoyed being there anyway. But it just... You knew, I mean, unless you were deaf, dumb, and blind, you knew you weren't going to be a top babyface because of that situation. Yeah.
And I'm wondering, did the heels kind of feel the same way about the Freebirds? I mean, they kind of drifted in and out a little more. They weren't as mainstay as the Von Erichs. But did the heels kind of feel like that too? Or was it kind of big money to be a heel down there because you work against the Von Erichs?
If you were fortunate enough to work in a main event, a semi-main event, you made some good money doing that. As far as, you know, I mean, they could have cared less how the babyface or the Von Erichs did as long as they got their money. And let's be honest, money talks and bullshit walks, and that's just the way it was. You know, and these guys, I never heard any of them complain, so evidently they did to themselves or didn't complain at all to anybody else that I know of.
Right. And definitely one thing I wanted to ask you was you did have a title reign as the Texas Heavyweight Championship, or the champion, right?
Yeah, right. And that... I was very surprised when they wanted to do that with me, but I guess it was just my, you know, because I didn't get in there and try to brown nose anybody or try to, you know, do anything more spectacular than I knew I could do. I just got in there and did my job, and I figured I'd let my work do my talking for me, and evidently it came across good enough, and that's why I got it. I held the belt for a while, and then you got to drop it and give it to somebody else, and that's just the way it went.
Yeah, and it's funny because the history books usually are pretty good for these kinds of things. It does not say anywhere online or any source how you lost the title. It just said that the record or they didn't have they couldn't keep track of the title reign after. How did you end up losing the belt?
You know, it's been so many years ago. I'm sitting here racking my brain trying to remember how that happened. And right now I'm coming up with a big zero. But I know I held it for a while, and I don't even remember how long it was that I held it. Maybe 3, 4, 5 months, something like that. And then I get in there, and David Manning, who was the Fritz's right-hand man, said, okay, we got to drop the belt, and you're going to, you know, I really, honest to God, don't remember who I dropped it to. You know, and it's just,
okay.
You know, I have no idea. But I know I had fun having it, and, you know, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no, you're good. I was just going to say that's totally fine. We're just wondering because it's very rare that you don't know because the record books go back to the 30s and, you know, the 40s. So I found it kind of odd that they don't have, not even on Wikipedia or anything, they don't reveal how the title was lost. They just say it was, like, vacated. And I just found that interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, you know, and I'll ask around and look up certain people, see if I can find out. If I can, I'll let you know.
I appreciate that. Yes.
Now, another, you know, kind of high-profile feud that, well, not necessarily high-profile, but another big feud that you had in World Class was when you were with Sunshine and you two feuded with Hollywood John Tatum and Missy Hyatt. How was Missy Hyatt, you know, back in those days? Because, you know, you hear stories of her later on, especially, you know, after, you know, her and John Tatum split and she went to Eddie Gilbert. But how was Missy, you know, back in the early days?
Any time that I was around her, she was a really nice lady. And, you know, you hear different stories about things with her and that, but I could not ever say anything about her being promiscuous or mean or ultra nice or anything. She just was a business person like the rest of us. And, you know, it's funny that you brought them up because I was at the gathering in Charlotte, North Carolina, and she was there, and I hadn't seen Missy in probably 30 years, 40 years, something like that. And she came up to me and gave me a big hug, and she said, "I just wanted to tell you thank you, thank you, thank you." And I said, "For what?" She said, "For help putting us over in the matches or whatever." And I said, "Missy, I was just doing my job." She said, "I know." She said, "But it helped me tremendously as far as having a living in the business." And she said, "I really, really," and John would have said the same thing. And I was very surprised, but happy about it. I mean, it was nice of her. But, I mean, she always came across like she was a, you know, a bad girl or whatever, but honestly, she wasn't. She was a really nice lady, and it was fun talking to her. And I think she lives in Jacksonville, Florida now, but outside of that, I mean, you know, we just talked that short period of time, but like I said, she was a real nice gal.
Right. And also, as far as the Texas territory goes, you teamed with Kabuki for a little while, right? And then he turned on you?
Yeah, that was fun. And I can't remember his real name, but I remember we were tag team and the people couldn't get over that, you know, him and me together, which was a rare switch, you know, because he was like a heel. And he never talked except in Japanese, except if you were in the dressing room. He could talk better than you and I do. But he was a real nice guy, and because of his gimmick, we got over great. And I guess partly part of mine, too, because I'm the cowboy and he's the guy from Japan. And he had this thing where carry these, I don't know, paint capsules in his mouth, and he'd hit somebody and he'd spit it out, and it would be a green, red, or whatever color he was using that night. And the people loved it. They went nuts because they'd never seen anything like that. And he was, his timing was impeccable. He knew what to do, he knew when to do it and how to do it. And I learned a lot from him. You know, like I said, you try to learn from everybody, steal a little bit from this guy or that guy, and it'll help you somewhere down the road.
What's funny about that, too, is WWE's kind of known nowadays for putting those odd couple tag teams together, you know, two guys you wouldn't expect. that was kind of one of the first examples of an odd couple tag team. So you guys might be owed a check somewhere.
Yeah. I'd take it. I damn sure would. But if you get down to World Class Championship Wrestling in San Antonio, that was one of the greatest, I don't know, what would you call it? Gimmick thing matches that I'd ever had was with Bobby Jaggers. I don't remember if you've looked all this up or not, but he had a thing where he said I was not a real cowboy. Well, hell, I raced quarter horses. I could shoe them. I did everything in the world, you know, with them. But for the gimmick, you know, he had his rub and I had mine. And we had a situation where he was out doing a promo, or I was doing a promo, and he came up on the stage and he started yapping and everything. And all of a sudden he turns around and he slaps me in my left ear, and it just blew my eardrum out. Oh God, I was ringing and everything. But the thing about it was, I didn't mind him hitting me. I wish he hadn't hit me there, but because I'm deaf in that ear now. But prior to that, I had a 20-gallon bucket of horse manure back in the dressing room, and we wet it down, and the guys would go and relieve themselves in it too. And they put it up on stage underneath the podium. And when he hit me with it, I honestly fell off my feet. And the thing was, and it took me a minute to get my balance and equilibrium back. But he starts talking. And he's rapping on and on and on. You know, we're trying to build this thing up between him and me. I pick up this 20-gallon bucket of horse manure, and I dumped it on his head. Now, he's working with the bucket, and horse manure all over the place. The announcer had to go change his suit. It was so bad. And when I looked at Bobby in his eyes, both of his eyes were blood red from the manure and from the urine and everything else. And it made us more money than you can imagine. And it was so much fun. But, I mean, God almighty, you know, you have to take your licks as well as giving them out in the business. And we did in that one, that's for sure. And I think there's even a tape on it or a disc or something that shows where I did that to him. And, God, it was unreal.
Yeah, we got to get a hold of that.
Yeah.
That's fine. Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to ask you. Do you still keep in touch with any of the guys from World Class?
Well, if they don't die off on me, I do. I mean, hell, I've had more friends die in the last 10, 15, 20 years than you can imagine. You know, it's just even Rip Oliver just died the other day. I couldn't believe it. You know, and I'd seen him in Tampa. They had Captain's Corner had a big thing there, and Rip came up and we hugged each other, and he looked great. And you know, I left after did my gig there, and it wasn't 2 or 3 weeks later, he's dead. You know, people like Harley Race, he's gone. You know, I mean, I keep waking up every morning checking my pulse, make sure I'm still here. You know, it's just, you know, but I mean, it's just, I guess that's life. Obviously, that's life, because none of us are going to make it out alive. That's what my old man told me years ago, and boy, was he right. You know, I mean, there's so many guys that have passed away that were great, great talents, you know, and it's sad but true.
Yes, sir. And World Class is kind of known for being that kind of snake bit territory from, like, they made a lot of money, but as far as a lot of the guys, you know, obviously the Von Erich family has had a lot of downs and deaths and tragedies, and that's terrible. And even Gino Hernandez and people like that, it's kind of known for those sad stories. And that's kind of sad because there was a lot of great wrestling that went on there. But you have a story with Gino Hernandez that I've heard you say before, but I definitely want our viewers to hear it because you kind of checked him back in the day, right?
Yeah, I just, he would start, you know, I'm better than this and that, and I'm prettier than all of you and all that. And I just tell him, I sat in the dressing room one night and he's talking, and I said, Gino, shut the F up. I said, nobody wants to hear your bullshit. And he started laughing. He sat down. He was fine after that. But he thought he was back out doing another promo. I mean, I never, you know, hell, I'd been in a business 15 years by that time. And I was not going to let some young guy tell me what I could not or could not do and how great he was and all that. I didn't want to hear it. I said, go tell somebody that gives a shit, because I don't. And he started laughing his ass off. And after that, we got along great because he knew I wasn't going to put up with it. You know, it's real simple. You know, I mean, I knew what was going on, and I was not going to let him get away with it, you know. Pardon my French, people, if you're listening.
Oh, no, you're fine. We're unscripted wrestling, so you're good to go here.
Well, you know, you just try to be polite a little bit anyway. But, I mean, when you get people that act like that, I mean, it's like being a real jerk, you know. And the guys are all of them sitting in the dressing room. Nobody's saying anything. And I open my mouth and I tell him how the cow ate the cabbage, you know. But it's just the way it was, you know. I'd had enough of it, you know, because I'd heard him do it before. So, but he, outside of that, he was a nice guy, you know. I used to call him Charlie all the time because his name was Charles Wolf, and that drove him nuts, you know. I said, Charlie, how do you do it? And he'd start laughing at me because he thought that was so funny, you know. But so I wasn't going to put him over with his bullshit.
Now you never worked the Mid-South territory, correct?
I worked for Ron Fuller in, I think it was Alabama, for about a month. And then Dallas, I think, wanted me to come back or something, or Florida. I can't remember. I mean, all those years ago and all those different territories, you know, I bounced from one to another. But I worked for them for a while. But outside of, and the Fullers were nice, Ron and Robert. And they were nice to be around. Way it went, you know. I mean, I wasn't figured in, so I didn't stay. You know, I wanted to make some money. I didn't want to be on the bottom, and that's the way it went.
Now, did you ever work for Bill Watts?
For Bill Watts? I made one shot in New Orleans. I was going through to Florida, and I stopped, and he asked me if I would work on his card. I said, sure. So I did. And I don't know, maybe I put somebody over, I can't remember. But that was the one and only time I was really around Bill. But
now,
I've heard stories.
your brother Steve, or the guy that was billed as your brother Steve, he worked for Bill, right?
I guess. I don't know. First of all, he wasn't my real brother, okay? It was just a working brother. And we fell out of sorts, and I'm being dead honest here with what I'm about to say. I went through a bad divorce, and I needed some help. And he said, now let me back up and say, my one that I had the bad divorce with introduced me to him. Good-looking kid, worked hard in the ring, but I said, Steve, that was his real first name. I said, Steve, I said, I need some help. I need to borrow some money. And he looked like me at me like I was a ghost. And I said, well, you know, he said, hold on. He went and talked to everything he did with his mother for some reason. And she told him to tell me to hit the road. I said, okay. I left, and I thought, you know, Scott, you dumb son of a bitch, you taught this guy how to work. You taught him how to make a living. He went around the world doing it, and yet he wouldn't help you out. And I would have helped him. I never charged him a dime, not one dime, for doing it. And I thought, that's the way you want to be? Then fine. Because I would have helped him out. I'd have given him the shirt off my back to help him. And I'm not trying to be a Mr. Nice Guy. That's just the way I was. And I would have helped him out. And it didn't work. You know, I told him, I said, I'll pay you back. No problem. You know, $400 or $500, something like that. And, it's just the way it went. And I said, okay, you want to be that way? Then forget me. And I haven't talked to him since. I've had a few people ask me about him. And outside of that, he was a nice guy. But, and I can understand, you know, maybe he, you know, money will make the best enemies out of friends. And maybe that's what it was. I don't know. But I'm telling you the truth. That's just the way it was. I needed help and I couldn't get it from him.
All right. Wow. Now, you went to New York around 87, 88-ish, correct? 88?
Right.
And and you were basically used as enhancement talent, correct?
Or a jobber, whatever, or jabroni, whatever, you know. It's like I was talking to Don Morocco the other day. He said, you know, us jabronis, that's what they used to call them years ago. He said, we put these guys over, and, you know, and that's fine. You know, I didn't mind doing it. And at least I got to go to the big show, and I got to be on some big shows and made a few bucks doing that. But it's just, if you're not figured in, you're not figured in. It's real simple. And I wasn't. And prior to that, down in San Antonio, we drew the biggest crowds they ever had, me and Eddie Mansfield, and the hair versus hair thing, and other angles of the shot. And it's just like somebody said, well, you know, didn't it bother you? I said, inside it probably did. Hurt my ego a little bit. It probably did. I said, but I got used to it, you know, because I was making good money up there. I mean, not tremendous money. But, you know, you stop and think, I was on the Survivor Series in 88. I think it was the first one they ever had. And there was like 8 of us, 4 on each side, or 10 of us. I can't remember. But the thing of it is, I worked for 3 minutes in the ring. Three. Not four, not two, 3 minutes, made $5,000. Now, gentlemen, when you can make that kind of money in 3 minutes or 5 minutes or 4 minutes, you're doing good. And I enjoyed it. And I stopped and thought about it. I talked with Mercedes Solis the other day, and we were talking because he was on the card with me. And he said, do you realize everybody that was on the heel side are dead? Andre the Giant, Rick Rude, Harley Race, and I can't remember the other one. But anyway, I said, no, I never realized that. But sure enough, that's what I mean about, you know, you just guys dying off all the time, you know. But when you get up around our age, that's understandable, you know. So that's the way it goes.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's sad, especially because now in today's climate, you know, we see it a lot more, especially with the Harley Race thing and Dwayne Johnson just passed recently. Not Dwayne, obviously.
Rocky
Johnson, my bad. But it's definitely sad, and it's part of life. And you know, it's hard because a lot of people, you know, watch these guys. You know, a lot of people watch you, and especially as the babyface, you know, you're a lot of people's heroes. Did you? Go ahead. I was wondering.
You're talking about, Go ahead.
I was just wondering, did you, because you said earlier that you did a little heel work or you tried it, and it went okay, but you were a career babyface. Did you enjoy being that role model and that hero? Was being a babyface, did you enjoy that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, just, and the thing about it now, you know, 30 years later, I still have people saying you were so nice to us and all that, and you were great to watch in the ring. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being a babyface and enjoyed being nice to people, because that's the way I was brought up as a child, to be nice to people. And it went over again into my wrestling career. You know, I saw guys treat people like shit. And I thought to myself, you know, why do that? Because these people are the ones that are paying your salary, whether you like it or not, whether you're pissed off or not, whether you think they're retarded or whatever. It's not right. You don't treat people that way. And that's just the way I was, you know. And, you know.
Now, Scott, who was your what was your best match in territories? Sorry.
I think my really best match I ever had was down in San Angelo, Texas, and I wrestled a guy by the name of Billy Robinson. Billy was the ultimate as far as timing goes, his ability to make comebacks, his ability to sell, everything. And, you know, back then we had to get the people interested in what we were doing. We didn't start out with a bang and end up with a whimper. We started out with a whimper and ended up with a bang. And I went 45 minutes with Billy in a match. And I don't know if he's from England, or he was from, I think he's passed away now. There's another one. And but he was excellent, and I learned so much from him, you know.
Yeah, Billy Robinson, definitely a legend in AWA, and one of the more underrated legends, much like yourself. I would definitely encourage our younger viewers and people who like today's product and, you know, whatever, I would definitely encourage them to watch some old Billy Robinson matches, because, I mean, just not only the technique, but the psychology he had in the ring, watching some of his old stuff. You know, he was a genius.
Yeah. Yep, he sure was. You know, you were talking about territories and the driving and everything like that. Outside of Amarillo, the worst one was Charlotte. And because, like, here's an example. You would leave Charlotte and drive up to Norfolk, Virginia. It's 440 miles any way the crow flies. And you'd get there, you'd have a match, and you'd have to turn around and come back to Charlotte because you had to be in South Carolina. I'm trying to think of the name, Savannah, or somewhere like that. So you're doing almost 1,000 miles in a day and a half. And it just... it was crazy. I've got a great story to tell you, fellas. We were up in Norfolk, had the matches, and back then, you'd have probably four guys in the car. We'd be splitting the trans and stuff like that. And we'd stop at the 7-Eleven, and it's what we called a baloney blowout. You go to the 7-Eleven, you get the bologna, the cheese, the mayonnaise, mustard, bread, case of beer, whatever. And you'd be driving back for that because you're hungry, you know, and you know you got to get back because you're going to be getting into Charlotte when the sun's coming up, right? So I'm with Bruce Swayze, Sweet Hansen, and Rip Hawk. And we're in Swede's station wagon. And Bruce said, watch this. Now, we haven't left the parking lot yet. And Bruce turns to Brute and said, Brute, are we home yet? No, okay. And he was always saying, it was never Bruce Scott or Swede. It was Cocksucker. Pardon me, people. That's just the way we talk. And he said, he keeps asking Brute this. Now, Brute is like 6 foot two, 290 pound, bald headed, and he's got a couple of screws missing up in his head because he just, you know, he didn't realize it was that Bruce was ribbing on him.
Yeah.
Down the road we're going. And Brute and Swede are in the front seat, and Brute is making the sandwiches, and Swede's drinking his wine, and we're eating the sandwiches. And Bruce is still telling Brute, are we there yet? Finally, Brute throws the mayonnaise, the bologna, the cheese, the beer, everything up in there. And he said, Katsuka, I kill you. Now, can you imagine a 290-pound man coming over the back seat, and he's strangling Bruce? And as a matter of fact, Bruce is still alive, and I just talked to him today. I love him to death. But anyway, and Bruce is laughing, and I'm trying to pull Brute off of Bruce. That's kind of hard to say. But anyway, Sweet stops in the middle of the freeway. Cars are whizzing by us. He gets out, pulls Brute off of Bruce, gets back in the car. And Bruce said, are we? I said, Bruce, this big bastard's going to kill you. And Swede said, say it again. Wow. I'm going to kill you. We're driving down the road. He slams on the brakes about, 40 feet from where we were. I said, what's the matter now? Nobody said anything. He said, well, Swede, we had false teeth. He said, I left my false teeth down there. He said, they were on my lap, and I got out to get you idiots apart. Goes back down the freeway in reverse, and all of a sudden he stops, gets out. We find the teeth, and I'm sitting there going, oh, shit. I said, we're going to all be killed. And we get back in the car, and he said, open your mouth one time, Bruce. He said, I'm putting you in the trunk or in the back behind the seats. I laughed my ass off. But, I mean, you know, back then we had the camaraderie. We had the fun. We did silly things like that, or ribs, as they called them, and that was just, I just remember that, and I thought, I got to put that on the air. And Bruce, if you're listening somewhere, he lives in Hot Springs, Arkansas, I don't know whether he is or not, but anyway, that one was for you. I mean, it was so funny, guys, you can't imagine. I mean, tears are running in my eyes, I'm laughing at it, and Bruce going, Doctor, I kill you. I'll tell you another quick story since you got me on the roll. We are at the Admiralty Motel there in Norfolk. And Bruce and I are taking steroid shots. I mean, I'm not going to lie about it. Yeah, I took them. I could never have gotten up to 250 without them, that's for sure. So anyway, we're taking a shot, and Brute, he never knocks. He always just opens the door and walks in, you know. And he said, what are you doing, cocksucker? I said, we're taking a little shot, trying to get as big as you, you know. Oh, it won't happen. He said, what does that do? I said, well, it enhances your muscles if you train and all that. Oh, instead of can I, he says, give me two shots. I said, what more? You're 290 pounds. He said, my wife, Betty, she is ugly, and I want to give her, I'll be nice on this, give her a punch in the pants, and I can't because she's so ugly. Now, Bruce has been dead for years. Otherwise, I wouldn't tell it because he'd drive to where I was at and kill me. But anyway, we gave him two shots, and okay. Now, in the Carolinas, you could go 2 or 3 weeks and never see the same guys. They had like three towns running, and you were constantly switching and changing up with everybody. And we finally get back to a TV taping, and I walked up to to Brute, and I said, Brute, how was your little problem? Ah, my valise. He said I went like a racehorse. She loved it. I said, great. And I'm sitting there. He said, by cocksucker, I gained 15 pounds. I went, oh, my God. He was up over 300 pounds in a while. Folks, I'm sorry. Like you said, it's a free show, but still, that's just the way we talk. And people were nuts back then and probably still are like that. But it was so funny. I gained 15 pounds. Oh, God.
So when you went to New York, when you left World Class, right?
Yeah.
Right.
You were still in the program with Sunshine and Tatum and Missy Hyatt, right? I believe I heard that program was still going. Yes, sir?
I don't know. They were never up in New York when I was there that I remember. Of course, when you get to be almost 73 years old, you can't remember your name half the time. Yep, folks, I'm going to be 73 the 19th of this month, so that's just the way it goes. But we did all of our stuff, I think, in Dallas. You know, I'm not sure.
Happy early birthday.
Now, going back to Southwest Championship Wrestling, when you were there, you got to work with Adrian Adonis, correct?
Yes, I did. And I was the undisputed world heavyweight champion there. Thank you very much. And Keith Franks is his real name. And, you know, he and I got along great. I mean, he was really goofy. He'd talk to you, and then, as we say in South Texas, he'd get that 40-yard stare on his face, and you wouldn't know what planet he was on, but he made it work somehow. But I had a good match with him, and the people loved it, and I had the belt there for a while.
Now, I've heard people say that Adrian, wasn't really a nice guy, that he bullied people, but you were able to get along with him. So, I mean, did he ever come?
I'm sorry, what?
Go ahead. I was just going to ask, like, did he ever come across as a bully to you, or was it just like you and him just got along?
No, because
fine?
I've been in the business long enough. I think maybe out of respect to me, he didn't do it. You know, I saw him bully a few guys, but, you know, if he'd look at me and say something, I'd just laugh it off or come back with some sort of answer that he probably wouldn't have liked. But anyway, but no, I never had any problems with him at all, you know. I mean, he even laughed at some of my jokes, in which I thought that was good. But he was just a little different, you know. I mean, we all walk a different path, and he just, you know, I mean, he got himself over being a nut, but he wasn't to me, you know, because he knew out of respect he wasn't going to pull that crap on me, because I don't care how good a wrestler he was or a bigger fighter he was, I wasn't going to put up with it. It's real simple. You know, you get a little respect the older you be in the business.
Yeah, and kind of branching on that respect point that you were just talking about, when you went to New York, when you took the trip, you went to the big show, the WWF, did any of the younger guys, because you were already a respected veteran at this point, did any of the younger guys come to you for advice, or maybe some of even the bigger stars, did they pick your brain at all?
Yeah, it's funny that you should mention that, because I thought about it the other day. I would work with guys that were their big stars, and some of them actually said, Scott, I'm sorry I had to put you had to put me over like that. And that was just out of respect to me. That's all. You know, it didn't make me a dollar or a dime or whatever, but they just respected me, and that's why they said it that way, you know. And I, that made me feel good, you know, because I knew I wasn't going to go anywhere on the card. I mean, they had a lot of guys, you know, Don Morocco and different guys like that. that would had been major stars and weren't doing anything up there. And but they have a committee of guys, and evidently they'll get with Vince and say, we like this or that, we think this or that, what do you think, boss? And that's the way it went. You know, they didn't you weren't figured in, you weren't figured in. That's all there was to it.
Now, this is kind of a big question, because this is a debate amongst a lot of people. Do you think that wrestling changed for the better when Vince kind of bought everybody out and started the empire that we know today? Or do you think that wrestling was kind of better off in the territory days?
Well, being from the territory days, I'd say it was better off. But, I mean, you had to work twice as hard to get half as much. Okay? And nowadays, it's all scripted. And the guys are, they're making a shit. They make more money in 6 months than I did sometimes in a couple of years, you know, and and I'm not bitter about it. You know, I mean, I had my time. I mean, look at it this way, you know, you used to could buy a Coke for 50 cents or 75 cents. Now it's $2.50. So everything changes in time, you know, and you just, I don't know. It's just like I told Booker T and his brother Stevie Ray, not what you make, it's what you save. And gentlemen, take that to the bank, because it's the truth.
Amen.
Amen. Yes, sir.
Now, you know, comparing like the territories, like comparing like Florida and world class, or you know, Florida and Texas, and the Carolinas, and, you know, all the different territories that you worked, which did you enjoy the most?
For Southwest Championship Wrestling, San Antonio. I had
okay.
more fun down there. I mean, you could take your time and do certain things that you could not do. Otherwise, you're catching a plane, train, or whatever to go somewhere, and we did it all by car down there. And they had trips there, too. But the people were nice. The food was wonderful. The climate was great, you know. And you're not going to get that three combination up in the Carolinas or New York or anywhere up north, you know. One of them is going to be messed up, you know. But I really, really enjoyed San Antonio. As a matter of fact, I'm thinking about moving back there after I finish this commitment I have here now, and see how it goes. But if you've never eaten real good Mexican food, gotta go down there, guys, because it's unbelievable. And there was a place, believe it or not, it was an Italian restaurant called Paisano's. And Joe Paisano owned it. And I got to find out if he's still alive, because the guy has a recipe for a salad that you would die for. But anyway, as I'm getting off the wrestling. But anyway, it's my favorite place to be, was San Antonio.
Right.
Sounds good. And another thing I kind of wanted to – you mentioned Charlotte earlier. Did you have any run-ins with Ric Flair?
Not really. I mean, I worked with him one time.
Okay.
And I had to put him over. And but he and I got along good, you know, because he was about my age. I mean, 72 now, I think, you know, you're behind me. But anyway, we got along pretty good, you know. And I was a wild man and young and chasing the women, and everybody was fair game as far as I was concerned. If they weren't married or in love with somebody, I was after them. And it may not be right, it may not be wrong, but just the way it was with me. I mean, I was just a wild man when I was a young guy. So it missed those damn days. I really do.
And from what we know about Ric Flair, it seems like you two lived by kind of the same philosophies on that regard, at least.
Well, yeah, I wrote it in my book. We went to Texas. What was it? Wherever the Cowboys had their stadium before they had this big one now. And we had a big match there and had a tremendous crowd, made great money. He picked up a redhead, I picked up a blonde. No, wait a minute. He picked up the blonde, I picked up the redhead. And we were all, this is, folks, I'm sorry, but it's the truth. I was a bad boy. But anyway, we got a room at the Holiday Inn. And if you see Ricky and you start remembering, asking him, he'll admit it. Anyway, I was with the redhead. He was with the blonde. And the redhead and I were shaking hands, and the blonde and him were shaking hands. I'm going to be nice about this. And all of a sudden I said, Rick. He said, what? He was the next room over. I said, meet me in the hall. Both of us naked as a jaybird. Met in the hall. I said, tag. Honest to God, it's the truth. I've got it in my book. And that's the way the night went. It was crazy. Well, we started off. We get into this room. He rents the penthouse. It's got a jacuzzi in the living room. The walls are got that type of wallpaper. It's red, but it stands up a little bit. The velvet type of stuff. But anyway, and had a white piano. It looked like a bordello. I've never been to one, but it's what I would imagine one would look like. But anyway, we get in there, and we're staying in. He had bought 6 bottles of Dom Perignon champagne. Gentlemen, they're not cheap. And we're standing there, and all of a sudden, I said, screw it. I started taking my clothes off, and the women are looking at me, and Rick's laughing. And I said, the last one in the jacuzzi is a rotten egg. Next thing I know, everybody's in the pool, in the jacuzzi. Now, if you could get a hold of Rick tonight, he would tell you the same story. And I'm keeping it as nice as I know how. But, ladies, I was not a nice guy. But, anyway, it was fun doing it, and it was just the way it was. Oh, Lord, I'm sure I'll catch more hell from that. But, anyway. The way it went.
That's all right. That's a great story.
Now, who, you know, we talked about like some of your favorite opponents, and we've seen you do interviews on like YouTube about some of your favorite opponents, and one of those opponents I actually want to ask you about is Johnny Valentine.
Lord.
You worked with him in Florida, right?
I worked with him in Florida. I worked with him in the Carolinas. And it's real funny. George Scott was a booker back then. And this was like, I've maybe been in the business less than a year. And I'm going to work with Johnny. And I'm standing in the curtains, and George behind me says, Scott, do you know Johnny Valentine? I said, just by reputation, why? He says, well, fight for your life. And he pushed me through the curtains. I went, what? I get out in the ring. Here's this 6'3" blonde-haired guy, and he's 255 pounds. And he is whaling the piss out of me. He didn't hit me in the groin. He didn't hit me in the face. But he waffled my back, my chest, my stomach. And, you know, like one of my old mentors, Les Thatcher, said, they come in pairs, brother. And by God, they did. I'm wailing back on him. And he knocks me out on the apron. And I'm just bruised from one end to the other. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, by God, I'm 1,500 miles away from Texas. I said, but I'll be damned if I'm going to let somebody beat on my ass and not beat him, give him the same beating back. So I get up, and he's got his back to me. And he had long blonde hair, and I grabbed it and yanked him back over the apron. And I hit him harder than I ever hit anybody in my life. You know what he does? Ooh. He goes, love it. He was like, I call it sadomasochism. He loved to get hit. Loved to it. And I thought, oh, God, I'm going to get beat to death now. But I get back in the ring, And because I was still a young buck, that's all he wanted to find out, if I had enough cojones to stand up to him. And I did, you know. I mean, I'd have fought anybody. I probably would have lost a lot of them, but I still would have. You know, I didn't give up on anybody. And he was just as light as a feather after that. He was working with me after that, as we would say in the business. And he was a tough son of a gun, I'm telling you. You didn't. I would have hated to really make him mad, you know, but had a lot of fun after that with him.
No, you didn't wrestle in Georgia championship, right?
I'm sorry, what?
Did you ever wrestle in Georgia championship wrestling?
No, I still, this interference here, say that one more time because it's not coming across to me. Did I wrestle what or who?
He was wondering if you spent any time in Georgia.
I went to Georgia with Tully, and we did a show down there, and I never really worked in the Georgia territory outside of that. I knew a lot of the guys that were there, but I didn't work there except for that one time on the show. And they had just started doing the cross the country, whatever they call it now, you know, going from all the states had it, you know, and we were there for putting somebody over for something. And outside of that, no, I didn't work. But...
A lot of your career you spent with Tully, and you definitely had great matches with Tully. He's been popping up around the scene nowadays, and his daughter Tessa Blanchard is doing very well for herself. What's some of the one of the better memories you have working with Tully Blanchard?
Telling him he was an asshole one time. He was always, I mean, like I said in the book, you were a real prick. And he was. That's just the way he was, because his father owned the territory and he made big money, blah, blah, blah. But him just like Gino. I said, all of your gaga is not getting over with me. So just keep your mouth shut or whatever, you know. And but I had a lot of good matches with him. I mean, after we got to know each other a little bit and understand each other, we had great matches, you know. I mean, a lot of stuff over the top rope, you know, out on the floor, you know, into the chairs, the tables, and the people, whatever. But I always had a good match with the man.
Now, when you were in New York, there's a special that's on the WWE Network. It's from 88, I believe. And you got to work with the Big Boss Man when he first came in.
Yeah.
Did you?
Wonderful guy. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, did you think that he was going to be as big as he was when he worked with Hogan?
It just, you know, situations turn into situations and you either make it or break it. And evidently what he did with Hogan got over with the people. I mean, this was one of the nicest guys. He's dead too, I might as well tell you. But and one of the nicest guys I ever met. His real name was Ray Traylor. And he used to laugh because I always used to make him laugh. I'd tell him funny jokes. And I always told jokes all the time. I don't know why, it was just silly me. But he was great to be with in the ring. His timing was good for a big guy. I mean, he was like 6'4" or 6'5" himself, you know, and loved him to death. Thought the world of him. I wish he was still here.
Right. Yeah, he was definitely one of my favorites when I was little, you know, obviously after he turned babyface. But another person I wanted to ask you about, too, and actually somebody that we've actually had on the show before, Barry Horowitz, another, you know, former enhancement talent. And you guys actually worked together or, you know, worked against each other quite a bit up in New York. What was he like to work with?
Yeah, I get on the phone on Facebook, and he's doing stuff promoting himself and all this. And I told him, one time I said, Barry, I texted out, I said, you are the reason baby oil has become a giant. This man used more baby oil on him. It's unreal. I mean, great guy, good worker to do and knew how to do it. And they should put him in the Hall of Fame there. They're promoting it right now, trying to get him. I don't know if they ever will let, as you say, the enhancement wrestlers get in there or not. But the way I look at it, we may have been enhancing, but by God, they couldn't have done it by themselves. Stop and think about it. And it just, you know, I mean, honest to God, I don't. Somebody must have just stood behind him with a bucket of baby oil every night and put it on it, because he was shining like a new dime. Honest to God, but great guy, I like him.
And that's the thing about the enhancement talent conversation, is because people back then and even now, they forget how big a part of the picture that you really are. You know, you in New York, you worked matches with Rick Rude and so some other big names, and you made them look like $1 million because that was your job, and that was a big deal in getting them over. Do you think that the enhancement talent role, because you've had big spots at other places. We've talked about your world title runs too and other territories. Do you think that the enhancement talent role kind of gets underrated?
Well, everybody has to know their place in the business. And as far as underrated, I don't know. I mean, it's just, however they want to throw you in there, that's what's going to happen, you know. And as far as underrated, they tell you what they want you to do and how to do it and when to do it. And that's what you have to do. That's kind of a hard question to answer, because I just let, like they used to say, let water running off a duck's back. That's the way I felt about doing the jobs for different guys. I could care less as long as I could make my money. And that's the way I looked at it, you know. But I don't think, maybe it was, but I never felt like it was that we were underrated or overrated or whatever. You know, and the people knew, oh, well, Scott's going to lose tonight because he's wrestling whoever. And just like I wrestled Big John Studd one night, you know. So, and it bless his heart. And he's dead, too. But he told me what he wanted to do, and I said, all right, we'll do it. I got through. Great, Scott. I appreciate it very much. One of the few guys, and this is another thing. I learned years ago from the old-timers, if someone did a job for you, you thank them. Thank them. You know, yeah. Get this piece of shit out of here. No, you thank them for letting you do the job for them. And I respected that. And it's funny, I was in, where was it? Where were we? Tampa or Lutz or somewhere like that. And a guy came up to me. I swear to God, I thought I'd never seen him before in my life. And he said, Scott, I want to thank you. And I said, what? And he introduced himself. He said, we worked one time in Charlotte, and I did a job for you, and you said thank you. He said, I've never forgotten that all these years. And I like that. I mean, that was worth gold to me, honest to God. But just the way some guys are. It's just the way you were trained, and out of respect for the guy that's doing the job for you. So there.
Yeah, definitely. And we got about 10 minutes left here. It's been a great episode. We really appreciate you having on. I was wondering if it's okay with you if we can do a little word association.
Sure.
So
one word
to the viewers. Yeah. So for the viewers or people that might not know what word association is, the three of us will each give you a name, a couple names, and then we'll just get either, it doesn't have to be a word, it can be a sentence or, you know, just your thoughts
okay.
on that particular subject.
Okay. Sure.
And the first name I wanted to give you is Hulk Hogan.
Very nice to me. When I first went to New York, I'm sitting at a table, and there must have been 400 guys in there, and Vince was getting ready to talk, and I felt these two hands on my shoulders, and I turned around, and there's Hulk. His real name's Terry Bollea, and everybody knows that. And I said, Terry, how are you? He said, I'll be damned. You know my real name? I said, yeah. I said, I remember wrestling on a card, and you were this tall, skinny kid out there in Hollywood, Florida, and you were watching me do my thing. He said, yeah, I always enjoyed what you did. And nice man. To me, he was.
Next name is Kabuki.
Kabuki. Great worker. Great timing. There probably wasn't one muscle in his body. He was just smooth as butter. But, I mean, the guy could do his thing in the ring. And I liked him. He was a hell of a worker.
The next name, the Ultimate Warrior.
Jim Hellwig. And he's dead. I hate saying that every time. But anyway, I nicked in my book, I talk about him, I call him Dr. Depression. And he said, why do you do that? I said, his real name's Jim Hellwig. And I said, Jimmy, you're always bitching and moaning and complaining. And I nicknamed the runs up there. It was the A team, the B team, and then the buttermilk run. And I was always on the buttermilk run because they didn't want to do anything with me. But anyway, he was pissed because I said, let me tell you something, Jim. I said, and I will damn sure guarantee this. He said, what's that? I said, no one looks like you. Now they got guys that got abs and stuff, but they didn't that much back then. But anyway, I said, and if you will just be patient, you will be their next world champion. Guess what, boys? More than a year later, he was. I had already been gone by then. But I didn't think that he was that great a worker. And, Jimmy, I know you're dead and looking down on me, but, I mean, with your energy and your enthusiasm and what you did in the ring – got over with the people. But good guy outside of that.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. Vern Gagne.
You know, I saw him one time at a show in Colorado Springs. I was working with Larry the Axe Henning. You know, you knew, remember his son. And he's dead. And I can't, Kurt Henning. And I waved, nodded at him. Outside of that, I never got to meet the man.
Last name here. Yeah. Last name here is going to be John Tatum.
Johnny. Good man, a little nuts. And I'm going to tell you this story on you, John, here, and maybe you'll hear it. But anyway, we were at the gathering in Charlotte, North Carolina, and there must have been 40 or 50 guys there. And this was months ago. And they had a ring set up, and they had a table and chairs sitting on top of the table. And it had Mark Lawrence, who was an announcer, John Tatum, me, and Al Perez. And it was a question and answer session. And there must have been three, four, almost 500 people there, and they were listening to this, and they were asking questions. And John loves his alcohol, and he was just shit-faced. And we get in there, and he's talking. He finishes, and I start talking, and he said, "The great Scott Casey, I put you over. You weren't shit before I got a hold of it." Finally, after a while, and I've got the microphone in my hand. We had one mic. It went from Mark Lawrence to Johnny to me to Al. Or maybe it was Al and then me on the other end. But anyway, I'd had enough of it. He would kept on and on and on and on, you know. And he's drunk. And I said, John, and the mic was on. I said, shut the fuck up. And he looked at me. I said, because of my bad knee, I walk with a cane now. And I said, I will wrap this around your goofy head. And he kind of quieted down, but he still wanted to say some stuff, but he didn't. And I thought to myself, you know, Johnny, if you can't handle your liquor, don't drink it. It's real simple. And he was in the ring. He was great to work with. We had a lot of fun, you know, and I did what he wanted. He did what I wanted. And we had a lot of great mixed tag matches. And that night he just twisted the wrong knob on me, and I had to lay into him a little bit. But it just, you know, I'm sure you've been around drunks like that that don't shut up and won't, you know, and let you talk, and that's what happened. So be it.
one of them's next to me. I'm just off. But so close it up here. This is a great territory discussion. I just want to remind our viewers, you know, tonight, search Scott Casey and the WWE Network.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Can you say it again?
Oh, it's all good. I would definitely encourage our viewers and definitely younger fans to, you know, a lot of them have the WWE Network or YouTube. Definitely search up Scott Casey and learn from a legend and, you know, definitely get in tune with your work. Everybody go pick up his book, One Last Ride. And if there's anything else you'd like to plug, sir, here's the floor.
No, you've got it. You know, I just like people that they like a good read, and it's a lot of funny stories and about true people. And like I said, I didn't throw anybody under the bus. I just left it like it was, and I didn't get anybody in trouble with their wives, and like I said, I could have. But it's called One Last Ride, The Tale of Cowboy Scott Casey, and I think you'll like it. I've done pretty well with it so far and hope I'll do better. But thank you for having me on your show. And it's a lot of fun, and I'll come back anytime to talk with you.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, sir. We'd love to have you back, and thank you for giving us your time.
Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome. All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Have a good one.
Have a good night.
All right. So
are we still in? So, everybody, that was Unscripted Wrestling. We're still on the air, Eric?
Yeah.
Okay. That was Unscripted Wrestling. That was our territory discussion. We will definitely be getting back into the subject at some point.
We'll do a part two, yeah.
We will definitely do a part two at some point because there's so many territories and there's so much to get into. It's such a rich topic.
We barely scratched the surface, but we picked the brain of somebody that was around for the territories, which is basically what we were what we wanted to do. But there will definitely be a part two because there's a lot more to get to, fellas.
Okay, we'll probably get another wrestler if we can, and maybe bring Scott back too.
Absolutely, we would love to have that happen. Make sure to check out Wednesday Night Wars. Is going to be this Sunday. We're going to have a little bit of a style change, but we'll talk about that Sunday. And then make sure to check out our show Friday. Our topic is undetermined right now. But, guys, it's been a great episode. Thanks for coming on, and we'll see you guys next week.
All right. See ya.
Thank you.